Human beings clearly stand atop the food chain on the planet Earth. We've survived as a species for eons now, and our brains have certainly helped us survive. But what is good for survival in the wild is not necessarily what is good for surviving and thriving in a world that we have largely tamed. Our guest this hour explains that thinking about thinking in his book, The Well-Tuned Brain, Neuroscience and the Life Well-Lived. Peter Wybrow, MD, is a psychiatrist born and educated in England, now the director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. Peter's written several other books, including American Mania, When More is Not Enough. Peter Wybrow, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Was American Mania a prediction that came true?
It was, actually. Well, that book was written, it started in the late 90s when we were, as you know, running towards the dot-com bubble. And then it was published 2005, I think, first, and 2006, just before the crash, the financial crash. And basically it argued that we were outstripping our ability to manage the economy by just a manic blip where we were busily seeing the world as being full of roses and it would be continuously expanding and we would never have any problems again, that capitalism had won and everything was going to be fine. And so we had a little manic episode, and then suddenly, as happens with mania, even in the individual, it collapsed, and there we were facing a major financial crisis driven by all sorts of things. I mean, we argued that the bankers were mainly responsible, but I think looking back, we all had a part to play in it. We all thought that life would be a bonanza from then on, and it turned out not to be. You can't live on debt forever, basically.
Well, the idea that there'll only be economic growth forever, it sort of runs up against the reality of finite resources.
It does, indeed. And, in fact, what we know about biology, which is, you know, if you know anything about biological systems, they're what technically scientists call open systems, which is that they interact with their environment, but they maintain balance by constantly exchanging with the environment. So once you move away from that into a positive feedback loop, eventually the whole thing collapses.
Which gets back to the question about the mania part of this, the idea that so much of the economy and economic activity is based on a shared psychology and a belief in something. And when something upsets that, we do tend to get a little crazy, don't we?
Yes. I mean, if you look back on the birth of the modern economy, which I talk about in this new book, which is it started with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but it was founded on the same philosophical principles as founded America. You know, America is the great experiment of the 18th century, of the Enlightenment period. And in those days, the idea that one could continuously expand things was made sense because most people didn't have anything. And so the idea of production being something that would sustain progress and give human life more than we had had made absolute sense. But now we've shifted our focus, really. There's a whole reason that we might want to go into there, but shifted our focus into the chasing ourselves, because now the linear progression of the economy is supported by consumption. And so out of production has come the necessity of continuing to buy in order to sustain the economy, which is driving our everyday life and is becoming essentially frenzied such that we don't know how to stop.
So the broad view, can we state it as simply as our brains are not attuned to the kind of world we've made?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. What has happened is that the ancient part of the brain, which is driven by the survival, essentially is focused on short-term advantage and curiosity and self-interest. You have to be self-interested to stay alive. And so that worked extremely well when there wasn't much around, when you had to find that fruit tree otherwise, or catch that bird, otherwise you weren't going to have supper. And that was fine, but now with a plethora of everything, including information, food, novelty, et cetera, that has tied right back into that very primitive sort, and the ability to command ourselves, which is a most recent part of the human brain. In fact, what makes us human is the capacity for control, not the capacity for indulgence. And so the old brain is being reinforced by the wonderful capitalist engagement with all sorts of new technologies and so on. So it's almost as if we're in a giant playpen, but we've forgotten how to control those urges. And what's happening is that, as everybody notices in their own lives, there's no time to do anything, no time to reflect, very little time to concentrate. And this has tended to take us off on a course where we are becoming self-destructive. One example of that was the 2008 meltdown, because, as we said at the very beginning of our discussion, you can't go on forever just expanding.
But, Peter, are we more than halfway to getting ourselves in tune already? I mean, for example, we do build permanent homes. We don't just let ourselves get rained on and that sort of thing.
Yes, I think there's a lot of cause for optimism. And the first step toward optimism is understanding ourselves. So the first part of this new book argues that, indeed, it's very important to know who we are. And we are not who we think we are, and we're not the rational creatures that we all believe to be. We're not, as the economists would say, a rational thinking individual who decides on the basis of objective evidence what to do with our money or with our time. We're actually driven by what I was talking about just now. So if you first of all recognize that we're somewhat self-centered, we're driven by the short term, we're very bad long-term planners, and we're continuously curious. So anything new, as you see from your cell phone, anything that comes in, we break off what we're doing to focus it. If we understand that, then we begin to think, how can we use these assets to enable us to do things that would allow us to focus on the long term, not the short term?
We will learn much more about how we can go about tuning our brains. The book is The Well-Tuned Brain. Peter Weibrow, its author, our guest. We'll come back and talk more with Peter and take your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the psychiatrist Peter Weibrow. He is the author of a new book called The Well-Tuned Brain, Neuroscience and the Life Well-Lived. The concept is about getting our brains to steer away from those old thinking patterns like see food, get food that came along from eons ago, and think in terms of how we can function better on the planet we live in today. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the title of the book, I understand there's a debt here to Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's he wrote something called The Well-Tempered Clavier, which was a series of music exercises basically when he went in the 1720s to teach in Leipzig. These were his students. And, of course, in those days, the piano, what we now know as the piano, was in fact the clavier, the harpsichord, essentially, and it used to have to be tuned just about all the time because passing weather would detune it. And he became expert at doing that very quickly. But so the metaphor of the book is that we all have a clavier, harpsichord, inside our heads, and if we learn how to tune it, and we become one with it, which is why Bach was so famous in his day, we can actually live a very comfortable and good life. It's just when we let everything run away from us and we don't keep it in tune that we get into trouble. So that's how the title of the book began.
I like the concept of the particular instrument, though, that's a little more cantankerous about coming out of tune with the weather than, say, a piano.
Exactly. So the weather these days, that part of the metaphor is the fact that we've built ourselves such a wonderful, enticing culture, especially in America, that we don't quite know what to do with ourselves. We're just becoming gibbering idiots if we don't think carefully about, and everything's out of tune, so...
So there are two major parts to the book. Part one is, who do you think you are? Part two is how to live. So well, let's start with part one, obviously. And the death of a pheasant actually serves as the first instructive tale here. How?
Well, you know, this is an interesting story. When I was writing the book, I was on sabbatical at Oxford University, where I have an appointment, and I was living in an area where the same big estate where Churchill was born, the family estate there. And they rear pheasants for shooting in the winter, but this particular pheasant had grown up there. He was probably 2 or 3 years old, but he was living in this area where they had been reconstructing a dam. So in the spring, suddenly, they reseeded all the area they'd been digging up and put big fences around it so the public couldn't get into it and so on. And this old pheasant had found himself to this place. And he was feeding on all these seeds and the worms and God knows what else. And he became so fat, he could hardly fly. But this was an example of being surprised by affluence. You know, after a terrible winter, the old creature had found something that, like nirvana. And so everybody would stand staring at him because he was such an amazing bird. Nobody ever seen a pheasant that size. But indeed, the end of the story, as I describe in the book, is he disappeared. And then one day when I was walking on the hill overlooking the lake, there he was. I could tell by the big talon, the big spurs he had on his feet. And that was poor old Henry, as we called him.
Or what was left of him.
He was a bird that couldn't fly.
Yikes. So
yeah.
As proto-humans, then, did our behavior mimic Henry's, the whole sense
well,
of, like, when food's
know,
in front of you?
Well, you at the core of our brain is the same, essentially the same brain, millions of years old, as Henry in a very crude way. So we share that basic core of neurology, and that is the part that keeps us safe. That's the part that is vigilant, but it's also addictive. That's the part that we can fall into the trap of. When we live in a world of affluence, we can fall into the trap of asking for more and more and more, because that was when we developed that capacity to survive, there was not much around. The problem is we've moved from scarcity to abundance, and when it's a mismatch between what we were as old creatures and what we are now. And the other important dimension of that is that we're habitually driven. Most of our behavior is not conscious, it's preconscious, and about 80% of what we do is learned at a very early age. So if you learn to eat French fries at the age of, 6 months, you're going to be eating them when you're 60, if you manage to get that far. And so I think that the cautionary tale of Henry the pheasant is that we are prone to the same addictive cycle as he is when you fall into an affluent circumstance.
Well, and there's an example, too, of what happens when you move from scarcity to plenty. And the Pima Indians is an example I've heard before, but you put it together very well in this book.
Yeah. Yes. What happened there, for example, was the Pima Indians, who had migrated down from Asia, and they were some of the first occupants of this particular continent. They live still in Arizona and also in northern Mexico, but they're divided now as a tribe. But they were subsistence farmers and hunters, and they could live on virtually nothing, and they lived a very energetic life. When the Europeans moved in to the West, and we began to put the Indian population into various reservations, most of their ability to hunt and so on disappeared, and so their diet became the Western diet, which was provided by the government, and they have extraordinary problems now with obesity and diabetes. And yet if you look at the other part of the tribe in northern Mexico, they actually have managed to maintain more or less the old diet and the old ways of behaving, subsistence farming, and they have a pretty normal weight. So it's an example of how the environment can shift the physiology in a way that is self-destructive.
It's been a few years now since I read the New Yorker piece about the Pima, but I think the diabetes rate was somewhere around 50%.
It's even higher now. It's way up there. The tragedy is it's the young children have that problem as well. And the other interesting thing is, as we've shifted our behaviors, this is not generally known, but the height of the American male, for example, is dropping. We're now, I'm about 5 feet 10 and a half, something like that. I'm now the average height of a man in the U.S., whereas the Dutch are about 4 inches taller than we are. And that never used to be the case. 50, 60 years ago, the Americans were among the tallest in the world. But that's another example of how we've become fat and shorter. And that is driven in part by youthful experience. So in terms of our early experience here, if we are thinking that our early feeding of children high-rich foods that we've done in the past, because we also have, in general, a very high incidence of childhood obesity, something like 25-30% now, that is very detrimental. It reduces the height of the individual, and it also increases the weight. And that means that probably some of the individuals in our who are now in their early latency and teens may not live as long as their parents.
The author is Peter Weibrow, M.D. He's a psychiatrist at UCLA. His book is The Well-Tuned Brain, Neuroscience and the Life Well-Lived. We're talking about the mismatch between what our brains are set up to do for our survival in the wild and what they can do wrong when we get into the better situation with abundance around us today. Peter, you do point to a cultural component to obesity, specifically in English-speaking countries. What's that about?
Yes, that's fascinating. The fact is that if you look at where the fattest people live, it's not entirely true, but it's predominantly so. Many of them are English-speaking countries, and so America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada's a little bit further behind, and England is right up there with the U.S. So one possible idea that I think makes some sense is that, and this explosion, by the way, began about 30 years ago, and it's tied not only to changing in the diet, but also changes in the stressful life that we lead with essentially a capital concept which is open and free market and very competitive. And so the notion, which has been well documented by a man, a professor at Oxford, named Professor Offer, he has shown very clearly that the obesity seems to be tied to the stress levels in these particular countries. And they're all migrant countries, of course. They all adhere to the same concept as drove the experience of the settlers in the U.S. And so there seems to be a correlation between stress and the development of obesity. For example, there's a high correlation between how many hours you sleep a night and how obese you are. And so if you sleep less, you are fatter, usually, because that's another index of stress, having little sleep. We all deprive ourselves of sleep several hours a day during the week and try to catch up at the weekends in this highly competitive and demand-driven society in which we live.
It's really weird to think about it in those terms, though, because obviously we emerged from a world in which we were not in control and had to take the food that was in front of us and had to try not to be eaten by things bigger and nastier than us.
Mm-hmm.
But we created this world of plenty, but then added this component of competitiveness for, well, survival is the way I guess we still view it. So it sounds like we're providing our own triggers.
Yes, we are, I think. I mean, poverty is very damaging to us, and also affluence is turning out to be quite detrimental as well. And so the whole point of the first part of the book is once you begin to understand these dynamics, you know, we're very intelligent creatures, and so we can actually modify our vision of how we should be living. Some people ask me, what's the book about? And I've begun to say, well, it's a mystery story, because you know, we know enough about this to help reorganize ourselves and reorganize the culture in which we live and so on. In fact, Oregon has done quite a bit in this regard. Portland is pretty much a model city in terms of trying to live a good modern life at the same time as to reduce the stresses and so on and so forth. But in thinking that through, we can change the way in which we behave. So it's a mystery as to why we don't. And we don't seem to have the political will to change it, even though we understand. We don't translate what we know in neuroscience into social policy, basically.
Well, and you probably saw the Time magazine cover story recently about who killed summer vacation.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you've put your finger on it. Well, who did kill summer vacation? We killed them ourselves. It's the same way as who created the 2008 crisis. Well, the bankers were greedy, but the rest of us were bowling along also thinking that debt was going to go on forever and linear progression, the whole world will continue to get richer and richer.
Take a home equity loan and buy yourself a new SUV. That's sort
exactly
of thing.
Buy yourself, get even more than that, you could buy a house with no money down, and it was escalating, one hoped, fast enough that you could borrow against it and buy your SUV. That's a pretty amazing trick, isn't it?
It is quite a turn of events, and turned out not to be a workable one down the road.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
So stress in the workplace, for example, then you talk about the various things that happen to the human body in there. So, for example, I mean, if we decide, you know, we're going to eat carrots at work instead of cupcakes,
yeah,
but the stress at work stays, will anything really change?
Good question. Well, I think that the answer is yes, some things might change, but the stress at work has to be addressed if you're going to engage some rational predictions for the future. You see, the secret weapon we have, which we've sort of lost track of, is that we actually can plan for the long term, and we are very good at thinking up novel ideas. So but we love novelty, so we should be focusing on how we create novelty beyond this highly competitive, demand-driven work. At the moment, we as my daughter, who's a sheep farmer, says, "You know, Dad, we've forgotten how to grow a tomato in our backyard." And in a sense, if you think about that, we've lost many of the skills that we used to enjoy because we don't foster them anymore. Take, for example, the idea that we have to go to college. Well, what do we go to college for? It's to learn how to live, among other things, not just to get a degree, which then you end up 15% of the people in New York City who drive taxis have degrees. But what do they do? It wasn't a degree in driving. So we haven't thought through how our investment in the present can help us in the future. It's the long-term planning that we've lost track of, which is the second part of the book, actually, which is how to live, you know, because we know a lot about how youthful children, for example, thrive and how they learn to trust and what the biology of all that is. And so we should be re-engineering thinking in terms of education, for example. There's a chapter on education, a chapter on habitat. In California now, we've just decided that you don't have to have a passing grade, a C, to get into community college. And so you can ask yourself, well, why is that? Well, because most of the children aren't making it, you know, and most of the people who go to community college, they don't get a degree in 6 years. And so you have to ask yourself, how is the educational system serving those individuals to give them a lifelong set of skills which will enable them to live a life well lived? And we are not thinking that through as carefully as we should.
Let's come back, though, to the brain. Because you do give some instruction on what goes on in the brain and talk about the three major parts here. Is it ultimately a challenge for us to figure out how to have our reason defeat, or at least hold at bay our instincts?
Yes, the part of the brain that is new and is probably only about 80,000 years old, somewhere between that and 200,000, is the part which is capable of long-term planning and self-command, as I call it. So the ability to learn how to project yourself into the future and to imagine the future. Imagination is a unique human capacity. You know, as I write about in the book, a dog can see a horse, and a dog can also see a man. But as Hobbes, the great philosopher of the 17th century, said, there is no dog that he knows which has created a centaur. You know, you're putting the two things together. So our imagination is what enables us to do all the wonderful things that we've done in human society. And my argument is that that particular part of the brain, which is the frontal lobe, basically, and the capacity to envision the future with experience and also by taking things that one's never seen but putting them in a different order so that suddenly all art is like this, we suddenly see it in a different perspective. That is an amazing advantage that we have, and we need to harness it within the context of understanding that we're habit-driven and self-centered and so on, all the things we were talking about. And I think then we have a really good shot of creating a society, especially in America, actually, where we have islands of innovation going on all the time, and putting those together in a way that creates a cultural revolution, and we then begin to look to the future as well as enjoying the present.
Well, enjoying the present is what we're really good at, but looking ahead to the future is obviously the challenge here.
Yes,
book is called
is.
The Well-Tuned Brain, Neuroscience and the Life Well-Lived. Peter C. Weibrow, MD, is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take a short break here on the Exchange. When we come back, we'll take some of your phone calls and emails for Peter and get into some of the ways in which we can go about tuning the brain. The Well-Tuned Brain, Peter Weibrow, and you back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the brain and how we use it in today's world, although it was actually constructed for a world eons ago. Psychiatrist and director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior, Peter C. Weibrow, is our guest on the Exchange. His book is The Well-Tuned Brain, Neuroscience and the Life Well-Lived. In a nutshell, we are built for short-term survival and have to overcome some of those instincts in order to thrive in today's world. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about tuning the brain. 800-838-3760 around the region by email jx@jeffnet.org. We've got a couple of calls waiting. I want to get to those, but I do want to get one major point included here before we move on, which is a point that Robin Dunbar, the British anthropologist, came up with that you include in the book about why our brains got so big.
Robin's concept, which I subscribe to, is that it's basically so we can keep social connections in order. You know, there is a very interesting correlation between the size of the brain and the way in which the social unit in which the individuals live, other primates and so on and so forth. The human brain can keep track of about 150 people in what's called Robin Dunbar number, which means that because of our intelligence, we can actually track all these folks in our heads, and we know enough about them to know how they're likely to behave in certain circumstances and so on and so forth. So that's the essence of how we are such powerful social creatures. And of course, it's not our brains per se, but it's the interaction of our brains with others that makes us so successful. And so Robin Dunbar's number is an exciting, I think, anatomical definition of what we do best and how we do best. And it's the implication of that is, of course, when you're on Facebook and you've got 6,000 friends, they're not really 6,000 friends. We have, it's like an onion. There's a small area in the middle. We all have maybe 5 to 10 really intimate friends that we would talk to in great moments of crisis, and that spreads out. But we can't keep track of more than 100, 150 people.
Okay, that's the number. Yes, I remember hearing about that earlier, too. The 150 is kind of our best place for communities.
Yeah.
John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Weibrow, the author of The Well-Tuned Brain.
Hi. I love your program, first of all.
Thank you.
My wife tells you I'm crazy for calling you every day. But I read an interesting study about happiness, and I don't know if this relates to what you're talking about, but it was about people who are considered to be middle class, like me, people who are poor, and people who are quite wealthy, super wealthy. And they said, as far as happiness, really, there's no difference between the middle and the high. But being poor is very difficult and must be tough on people's, I don't know if this fits into your conversation, but anyway.
Yeah, there are some good. There's good evidence, that, as you allude to there, that below a certain level, people are stressed out and unhappy. And interestingly enough, increasingly, there's evidence that above a certain level, people are stressed out and unhappy. You know, I see lots of people here in Los Angeles who are extremely wealthy, and their kids are very screwed up, largely because they have not entered into this opportunity for self-command. There's a balance in between. Many of the studies suggest that it's at around $10,000 that people feel basically in. This is a world figure, of course, not just internal to America, but that so an adequate material life is important to feeling happy. But happiness in itself is perhaps not what we're really talking about here. It's a sense of well-being, that you have some control over your life, and that so happiness is a bit like price in the marketplace. If you think about happiness, when you say to somebody, "I'm reasonably happy," what you're evaluating is your own sense of contentment and balance within the life that you're leading. So, but you're quite right. The economy at both ends of the scale disrupts that sense of balance and completeness.
Here's another call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Weibrow.
Good morning, Peter. Good morning, Jeffrey. I've tried not to call into this particular show because there are too many things I would want to talk about. So I was told to cut it down. Okay.
All right.
First of all, I translated a book called The Healing Brain by Ornstein and Sobel. You may know that.
Uh-huh.
And when you translate, you really get stuff in, because you're not translating words, you're translating meaning. And so that's sort of the background. You mentioned we in relation to human race or to human beings.
To greed, did you say? You said greed? Hmm? Did you say greed?
No.
We. Okay.
We, yeah. Us, you and everybody.
Yes.
Now, you and me is not everybody.
No.
There are people who sort of, we would like to say, run the show, which is a little too general. But the way in which creativity is commodified is sort of really undercutting the capacities that you're talking about, the way to the stress so many people experience is caused, I think, by their losing the capacity to apply their own creativity to resolve the future problems. Or
No, I would agree with you. I think that
you know what I'm saying.
Yes, so, I think you put your finger on it.
We are not in charge of. We are not necessarily in charge of that. I mean the mortgages and buying all the stuff that we don't need and making payments and doing the job and doing Facebook and my life doesn't exist unless 60,000 people know about it. All of this stuff that we are strung into a kind of a slavery that mm-hmm. takes us out of the autonomy of using these capacities.
All right,
to be content.
All right.
Well,
thanks,
I think sense. Yeah, I would agree with you. I would call it craft. You know, there are many, there are wonderful things that each of us can do, but we need time and you need the opportunity to focus on those things in order to be able to maximize their utility and also their pleasure. And unfortunately, the hell to leather program that we've built in terms of the driven market culture in which we now live, that narrative doesn't allow for the sorts of things that you're describing. When modern capitalist systems were invented by Adam Smith in the 18th century, most people were making their own furniture, if they had any furniture at all. But they, and also the center of the economic life was the same as the center of the family, in the sense that most people lived an agrarian life. So we have removed that, and I think we have, which is the implication of your question, we've also removed many of the pleasures of self-satisfaction, of mastering certain things, whether that's, you know, being a good farmer or a good husband or whatever else. The fact is that we need to create the opportunity for individuals to invest in the lives that they're living. And at the moment, we distract most people in investing in the lives that they're living.
So you mentioned Adam Smith. I do want to touch on that period in history, but let me go back a little further first, because you do mention medieval times in here briefly, and I don't think you're quite this explicit. You do point out that devotion to God and church was big then. Is the comparison that consumerism has become something like our religion now?
Yes. I mean, I think it's certainly the dominant narrative, isn't it? When things start to go down, we are urged to go out and shop, because that's what keeps the linear economy moving. And so I think that that's dangerous. But the other interesting thing about religion is that, of course, it is a function of human imagination, in the sense that we connect ourselves to the past and to the future through that. And that isn't a pejorative statement about religion. It's a fact. And so when we talk about religion, this was one of the great concerns of people in the 18th century, that as the church in Europe, predominantly then the Roman Catholic Church, declined, that we would lose our capacity for self-command, because we would not be able to control the more primitive instincts that we have. And in some senses, although one can argue with that particular detail, it has happened that we are increasingly lacking in our ability to command ourselves, and that now is what we should be focusing upon in terms of a function of education and the rearing of young children, which is I say a lot about in the early part of the second part of the book, because it is self-command, and that used to come through religion, that enables you to put off some of these things which otherwise are self-destructive, such as the overeating that we talked about at the very beginning of the story.
Well, since we moved on to the discussion of children, let's bring in Sandy in Mount Shasta, who I think wants to talk about just that. Welcome to The Exchange with Peter Weibrow.
Hi, Jeffrey and Peter. Wow, what a wonderful show. I've spent the last half hour scanning through your book, searching it on Amazon, and growing more excited by everything that I read. I think you're pulling together a whole bunch of really important ideas and how they affect us in so many areas of our life. And I'm particularly thinking of in recent years I've been working with young children, because I've grown more and more convinced that since the world I grew up in, I'm pushing 70 now, and so I've been around and I've watched a lot of amazingly dysfunctional things happen to my species and my culture. And I've long wondered, what is it that keeps these things so intractable? And I've come to believe that a lot of it has to do with how we raise children, and we don't, particularly in modern life, we don't recognize the importance of children's play for growing human beings that are capable of creative problem solving. Mm-hmm. We start shoving them into earlier and earlier academic things. There's a real push on right now. People are trying to make kindergarten and first grade, they are doing that in some places, and it's a terrible error, because it completely flies in the face of what we know about their emotional and cognitive mm-hmm. development overall.
Yeah.
So, I guess I would like to hear you talk some about that.
Well, you and I are on the same page there. I think that the way out of this conundrum is indeed to reinvest in early childhood experience, and we don't do that very well in terms of our social policy, as I mentioned earlier. I mean, the fact is that we're the only rich country in the world which does not enable parents, or at least the mother in most countries, and certainly in some also the parent, the father, to choose whether they want to spend some time with that young child when first born for several months and begin to bond with them, because and go back to work and have a job at the end of it, because most people would lose their job if they did that here in this country. So I think that it's so vital, as you point out, that what happens in those early months, the brain is wiring up so rapidly, and we call it love. But we know a lot about the mechanics of love and the chemistry of love, and that is what turns into trust. In fact, I talk in the book about my daughter's sheep farm, where, because you can learn a lot from sheep about the way in which these bonds occur. And my little granddaughter, who was brought up among the sheep, she has all sorts of interesting things which are analogous to the experience of the young human infant. And so the love turns into trust, and then trust turns into a sense of self control, which then becomes the essence of what one needs to teach in school. So it's a continuum, which then also, I think, spills over into the types of habitat that we build and the way in which food helps unite that habitat and where's the food come. So the way to think about human development is in a continuum. And what we've tended to do, which is what you were referring to, is we've sort of industrialized human development, as we've industrialized so many other things, farming and manufacturing and so on and so forth. And the industrialization takes out exactly what you were talking about, which is this capacity of a child to just be somewhere and to discover that somewhere by sitting and perhaps playing with an old tin can, or sitting in, you know, on the grass outside and watching the insects jump up and down. I mean, these types of engagements are somewhat, not somewhat, unfortunately, frequently now completely obliterated by the technology which we throw at children, in part to keep them quiet, because otherwise they'd be asking lots of questions. And secondly, because we're all so busy, we can't invest in the time that it takes to engage the child. All these things are extremely detrimental, and I believe in the long run, they begin to erode the fabric of society in a way that we don't understand until the situation gets to the point of crisis. And so, again, there are islands around the country where people are recognizing this and they're trying to make a difference. My hope is that by writing a book like this, and I know it's pretentious to try and put all these things together in one place, but my hope is that we will be able to unify by having these islands of sanity coalesce, and we can indeed shift the culture.
Sanity rather than mania, the reference to the earlier book.
Right.
The Well-Tuned Brain, Neuroscience and Life Well-Lived is the book. Peter Weibrow is its author. He's been our guest. Peter, thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.